Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play. Greetings and welcome to the December episode. I'm the magazine's editor, Chris Bramley, and I'm joined in the studio today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
And production editor Dave Golder.
Hi there.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Richard McKim from the British Astronomical Association about how your back garden Mars observations are used by scientists studying the red planet. And we'll be telling you our top tip for stargazing this month. But first, in the December magazine, we're looking ahead to the top events taking place in the night sky next year. So we thought here we'd do something a little bit different and look back over the last 12 months.
Mm. Yeah.
Ian, what's one thing that's stuck with you from 2018?
Well, for me, the two biggest stories happened in the past few months, really. It was kind of the end of the Kepler and the Dawn missions. Two very different missions. The Kepler Space Telescope was launched in 2009 and has kind of been studying stars, looking for dips in light that could indicate exoplanets, other planets beyond our solar system. And it came to an end this year. And the Dawn mission was kind of surveying the asteroid belt, looking at the two largest bodies in the asteroid belt, Ceres and Vesta, and kind of beaming back data. As I suppose kind of that kind of way, it's kind of part of that wave of post-Voyager space exploration, you know, that kind of Cassini was part of as well. But Kepler, I mean, like when you kind of look at how it changed our view of the universe, I suppose. One of the kind of biggest discoveries it made was that for every star we see in the night sky, there is, on average, a planet in orbit around it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
When the three of us were at school, you know, we learned about nine planets. There were nine planets, yeah. And then they dropped one and there were only eight. But now there are like, Kepler's discovered over 2,600, I think, exoplanets.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's really kind of, it's been a step change in what we know about the galaxy and about the abundance of planets. It's really kind of epochal, isn't it, this understanding that we have now?
Yeah, definitely. And I think kind of one of the really big things to take from it is we assumed, well, I say we, you know, I haven't done much kind of planetary science, but planetary scientists, I mean, up until the discovery of all these other systems around other stars, we only had our own solar system as a point of reference. So it was assumed, you know, that you had to kind of take it that, so around a star, you have the inner planets are small and rocky, and then the massive gas giants are further out. But now we know about hot Jupiters, which are big planets that are bigger and more massive than Jupiter, but orbit really close to their star, so they're absolutely scorching. So that's another thing. It kind of showed us how, so like, planets orbiting other stars isn't necessarily
our system isn't the only system.
Yeah.
There can be other ways that the galaxy can sort itself out.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, but I think one of the other kind of reasons that Kepler is so important is the fact that it's provided a database for kind of future missions to look at up close, like TESS. The TESS exoplanet survey is already kind of currently beaming back information, and also, you know, JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, among other things, is going to be looking at exoplanets, and there's a few European missions coming up.
Why was Kepler retired? Did it just run out of steam or break down, or they just got fed up with only detecting gas giants?
Yeah. I mean, that's it, really. I mean, because the current mission was called K2 because in 2013 it was announced that it wasn't going to continue looking for planets using the transit method because there were basically problems with the hardware. It was like it issues with two of its four reaction wheels failed, so then they had to kind of do the K2 mission, which was a follow up. So I think it's kind of just really reached the end of its life. Whereas the Dawn mission has actually kind of run out of fuel, and it was a spacecraft that was launched 11 years ago to study Ceres and Vesta, as we've said, the two largest bodies in the asteroid belt. Mm. And yeah, it's again, just like Cassini, just like Juno, it's kind of brought back these amazing images of our solar system. And one, I suppose, kind of the most iconic thing that I think, the most iconic image, I suppose, was the bright spots in the Equator crater in Ceres, which they think might be like salt deposits.
Yeah.
And it's also found at cryovolcanoes. It also found on Vesta, it found mountains like a mountain like Mount Everest. And
crazy that on Vesta, such a small body, isn't it? But it's got such amazing kind of topography.
Exactly.
Kind of hard to get your head around, isn't it?
Yeah, and then the possibility that there might have been once been an ocean on Ceres, you know, so it's not just icy moons and rocky planets. You know, dwarf planets could have moons as well.
But it's very interesting, isn't it, that all this kind of, like you said, the kind of post-Voyager survey of the solar system. It's very interesting that kind of we're doing that. You know, we've now visited every planet in the solar system, and we've done a kind of initial science survey. We know what's there, and now we're getting a bit more information about all these bodies. But I think with asteroids, it's particularly interesting because that is like our kind of stepping stones to becoming a planetary society, as it were, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're the linchpin of the space economy, where we're going to get all the raw material to kind of make the oxygen and the rocket fuel to kind of forge further ahead into the solar system. So it's quite an interesting first step in that exploration. Well, thanks, Ian. And Dave, what do you remember most from 2018 then?
I remember the start of the year, it was just getting excited about how many days we could go without a sunspot. I remember getting obsessed with that for some bizarre reason. but apart from that, it's the fact that, like, Britain is now back in the space race.
Whee!
The space egg and spoon race, probably, but I don't think we're going to be like launching like massive NASA style things out of the far reaches of the universe. But we are going to be launching stuff from Great Britain.
That's good news, isn't it?
For the first time, and it's like, a peninsula in Scotland's North Highland coast has been identified as the site of what will be UK's first spaceport. And it's in a peninsula called Armoyne. I hope I've got that somewhere near right. I know there's people online like leaping on everybody who pronounces it wrong. But like, that's in Sutherland, which I looked on the map just before we go up here, and it's right at the very, very top of Scotland. In the kind of flat bit before it goes to the Orkneys and and that's going to be in operation within the next 3 years. And that's going to be vertical takeoff rockets going up there. Two companies operating out of there. It's Lockheed and another British company called Orbex, I think it was. Right? Again, get confused because Virgin is called there. Now called Virgin Galactic has now become Virgin Orbit. The other company operating out of Sutherland will be Orbex. Both of them they're only going to be small rockets, not going to be massive, the kind of thing.
Saturn V,
nothing like that. Yeah. They're going to be tiniest, but smaller than Ariane, considerably smaller.
Yeah.
And they're going to be launching satellites, aren't they?
Yeah, that's exactly it for the moment. It's not the, you know, top grade exciting stuff, but it is exciting just to think that we're taking those first steps into into a space economy, which hopefully will become massive in the future. We're aiming, I think it's going to be billions worldwide by 2030. So, and it is exciting. And also, but apart from just that site, almost definitely we're going to be getting launches by Virgin Orbit from Newquay in Cornwall.
Wow.
But that's going to be horizontal takeoffs. Using a converted Boeing 747.
We've got yes.
Go Faster red stripes painted on it.
Yeah,
called Cosmic Girl.
Yeah.
That seems almost definite as far as I can tell. I was just reading their website and Cornish spaceport website, and they seem pretty certain that that's going to happen. And there's a couple of other contenders. My favourite one, although I must admit reading them all, seems to be the least likely this is going to happen, is one near Campbelltown in Scotland again. And the reason I like that one is because it's near the Mull of Kintyre.
Oh,
so
nice.
We can all redo the lyrics to Mull of Kintyre, spaceships rolling in.
Very nice.
There's also Snowden is in the running as well. They're getting a dead What I should say is the government is created a development fund for all these places. So in County of Gwynedd, where Snowdonia is, they're in the running as well. So it's all very exciting. Even if only two of them ever work out, we're still launching stuff. And I just think it'll be a great tourist thing as well.
I
want to travel to these places and watch things take off.
There's something about the kind of watching something just going. Yeah, and where it's going out, it's leaving the planet and going out to space. It's just an incredible thing to kind of watch, isn't it?
And the only other thing that struck me is that they're looking at all of their artists' impressions of how they're going to develop these places. Is they're clearly all been influenced by Thunderbirds. I'd be surprised if all of them end up looking like those.
Like covers that open up and then everything comes out for us.
Genuinely, it doesn't look like it happened because they look like Tracy Island.
Brilliant.
But you kind of wonder whether or not this is like something that can eventually be built upon. I mean, obviously, I'm not like a space flight expert or anything like that. You kind of wonder, is that then the potential, if everything goes to plan and it becomes more developed, to launch bigger rockets and kind of...
I would hope so, and I would think everybody involved would hope so too. It would be nice to think that, Professor Quatermass's dream will one day come true. You'd think that's where it's going. These are like small steps, and hopefully 20 years' time, 30 years' time, we'll be actually... doing proper, great, exciting.
Maybe it'll be really exciting, isn't it?
An ESA space port or something.
We've certainly got the skills. I mean, that's the thing. Why should our people, all our technicians and people with the knowledge, go overseas to do these things?
It's one of the things that we really do well, isn't it? Kind of satellite technology in the UK is forging ahead. I mean, we've got a really strong technological base there. Yeah. So it makes sense to kind of press ahead with it.
That's right.
Because currently the satellites they made in the UK have to be shipped across to be blasted off in other places.
For me, I think I've been thinking back over some of the practical astronomy highlights of 2018, and slightly weird one. This one I'm going to pick out was the lunar eclipse of 27th of July, because it was billed. It looked like such a good event. I mean, when you were looking at it in Stellarium and got your planetarium programs launching. When I first saw what was going to happen, my jaw dropped, and I had a kind of cold tingle running up my spine, because here was this lunar eclipse. A blood moon rising from the horizon, already eclipsed, so it would be red as it rose. Mars was going to be just six degrees from it, so really close by. To the naked eye, that would have been a beautiful apparition.
Mm. And didn't we also work out, because we're based in Bristol here, we worked out that we'd be able to see it from the Clifton Suspension Bridge?
Yes, we would be able to look down from the Clifton Observatory and have a view of the Clifton Suspension Bridge, the nice hill behind it with the fields behind, and then the moon rising up behind that, which would have just been jaw-dropping. What happened? Clouds.
What always happens?
Of course, it was clouded out. And so our hopes were dashed, and we had to satisfy our longing for those sites from photos from around the world.
It wasn't even just the fact that it was clouds; it was the fact that it had been cloudless for like weeks beforehand.
It was like that. I mean, we had a really good summer this year, didn't we? We had an awesome summer, loads of clear nights, loads of really hot nights as well, which is great. You can go out in a t-shirt at night with a pair of binoculars or a telescope and do some stargazing. But it wasn't to be. We were thwarted. our hopes were cruelly dashed by the British weather.
Did anywhere in the UK actually have a gap in the grounds? A gap in the clouds?
I think there were some people that got lucky, and they maybe had a fleeting glimpse of it. through some high altitude haze.
I seem to remember we got some pretty good images sent in by readers quite a few of them were from the UK, so I think some people did.
Yeah. Some people got really lucky, very local kind of gaps in the clouds. But the other thing, Mars, we talked about Mars. Mars was in part of that lunar eclipse, but Mars was also at opposition on the 27th of July, and it was what's known as a perihelic opposition, when Mars is at its brightest and best in the sky, the best time to see it for, you know, for a year or year and a half, I think they come round. And this particular eclipse was when Mars was closest to Earth. And that's has quite an effect on how Mars looks to the naked eye, because the difference between when Mars is closest to us at opposition and when it's furthest away, it's about double the size. So it was really, really bright. It would have been really, really bright. And people were, you know, looking forward to seeing quite a bit of detail on it and stuff. But there was, of course, Mars has its own weather problems, and there was a huge planet-wide dust storm. Mm. And so it knocked out all the detail that could be seen.
That went on for months and months.
And actually, NASA's still having problems with Opportunity because it relies on solar power. It put itself into hibernation when the power went down from its solar panels, and NASA still hasn't regained contact with it, although it does know where it is. It's managed to see it in some satellite photos from Mars. It still just can't communicate with it yet. Perhaps not the best. Two great events in 2018, perhaps not the best, but, you know, we do have a comet Wirtanen is getting higher and higher in the sky this year, so perhaps there might be something to look forward to, as the year draws to a close. And going back to Mars, I think, Dave, you talked to someone about Mars recently, didn't you?
Yeah, well, one of the other features in the current issue is about how you can give your images of Mars much more scientific value. They don't have to be pretty. You don't just have to send them in to us so we can admire them. There are scientists out there who will actually want to look at your images and get proper scientific value out of them. And Dr. Richard McKim, the British Astronomical Association, the Mars Division, I had a chat with him about how you can actually make your photographs of more scientific value.
Well, my name is Richard McKim, and I'm the director of the Mars section of the British Astronomical Association, which is a body that collects and analyses amateur observations of Mars.
And how long have you been in that role?
Well, I've been in that role a long time, over two decades now. So I followed Mars for a long period of time and seen many spacecraft come and go, but the amateur fraternity is still there out in their backyards getting observations and images.
So were you actually actively interested in Mars beforehand, or was it a role that you fell into and now it's just something you love because it's your life?
I've always liked amateur astronomy, and I always noticed that there were more books about Mars than any other planet. So it must have something of interest. And of course, there's a lot of science fiction about Mars, which is another hobby of mine. So it was an ideal planet, really, to study. It's a frustrating planet to observe in many ways, but a great challenge to the observer.
And why do you say frustrating?
It's frustrating because Mars is often a very, very small object in the telescope. When it's close to the Earth, it can be really still quite small for the amateur astronomer to see. Some oppositions are very much better than others because Mars has an elliptical orbit. So sometimes it's quite close to the Earth and sometimes it can be quite far away. And those times make it really very frustrating to observe.
Yeah, because its apparent size is the biggest variation of any of the planets, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Really, really massive variation.
And so we're specifically talking about there's a feature in our latest issue about imaging Mars for science and how amateur photographers can actually be involved with this. So how can they be? I mean, what are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for good quality work. The quality of images that amateurs can get with, say, a 25-centimetre, 10-inch telescope these days, the detail that is recorded in those electronic images, thanks to the sensitivity and wide availability of CCD cameras, is much greater than would have been obtained with the planetary photographs that were taken with the 200-inch on Mount Palomar back in the 1950s when they were commissioning that telescope. So we can get high-quality data with backyard telescopes, which can be put to scientific use.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but obviously you said you've been in this role for a long time, so you must have seen some great advances in the actual images that you're getting.
Absolutely. When I started this particular role, the first time that I analysed observations of Mars was back in 1980, and almost all of the material consisted of drawings. Then we had photographs. Then we had better photographs due to a revolution in the way that certain films were made and treated. And then we had the CCD camera, and then we had the web camera, and then we had the software for the web camera. So over the years, I've seen rather blurry shots of something that might have been anything to images that were, as I say, really much better than the world's largest telescope back in the days when film was used. So I've seen tremendous changes over the years.
But how specifically can these amateur observations help science? I mean, you would have thought that the layman would have just thought that, that all the big professional telescopes out there get all the information you need. So what are these contributing?
Well, of course, a lot of professional telescopes aren't directed towards Mars. They're directed towards deep sky objects. But amateur observations are useful in that they provide a continual level of coverage. Until quite recently, spacecraft around Mars and to Mars were quite occasional, and we didn't get that consistent and continual coverage. So lots of events, Martian atmospheric events like dust storms, for example, would have been missed by a lot of the spacecraft that went there. Another point is that some of the spacecraft that have taken images of Mars have taken images just at a certain time in the Martian day, and they've missed phenomena in the early morning, which amateur astronomers have covered. So the great thing that we've got is a very large round-the-clock watch on Mars, which does display unusual phenomena from time to time. So we've caught a lot of things that have been missed by professional astronomers and even by spacecraft that have been in orbit around the planet.
Can you think of anything specifically?
Well, there was one very unusual phenomenon back in 2012 where the spacecraft's images at the time were taking images in the afternoon, and amateur astronomers observed a very unusual phenomenon in that year, which consisted of a very high-level cloud, which was seen at the morning terminator. And you can think that when you look into the sunset sky, you often see very high clouds that are lit up underneath by the sun long after the sun has set, and that's on account of their very high altitude. And with Mars in 2012, we had a series of these phenomena seen at the, as I say, at the morning terminator, which were unobservable by the spacecraft due to the routines that they had. And what was very unusual about these clouds, we've seen many clouds on Mars before. We've seen most of the clouds tend to be at fairly low altitude. Some are dust storms, some are white clouds, and we're talking about a few tens of kilometres. But this particular one, when we measured the images, had altitudes of 200 to 250 kilometres. So these were technically clouds that were outside the normal atmosphere of the planet, and there must have been some connection with Martian aurorae. So they're very unusual, they're very temporary phenomena, and they were completely missed by spacecraft.
Excellent. That's an excellent example of how this kind of amateur science can lead to something quite exciting.
Absolutely.
And what are the best practices for people who want to submit photos? What should they try and make sure they do?
Well, I think the most important thing is to tick all the boxes with the data. There's nothing more frustrating than getting an image from somebody who's put the date on and not the time, or used a different time system, or used an American time system. It's best to use universal time, which begins at midnight and goes through to midnight the next day. So that's very important to get that system right. We want to know the size of the telescope. We want to know what sort of camera the person is using, because some cameras are excellent for astronomy and some of them don't have the high sensitivity across the whole range of visible wavelengths. Some of them, for example, aren't very receptive to blue light, which is very important in observing Mars. So we want to know what sort of camera it is, telescope, what sort of conditions, and sometimes it would be quite useful to know to what extent the image has been processed, because a lot of images need to be processed to bring out the best details in them.
Absolutely, yeah. And you like all that information actually included on the image itself, don't you?
It's useful if it can be, although when you're in contact with a new observer, they normally introduce themselves and give some of that information at the beginning. But at some point, we'd like to have some record of that information so it's not lost to posterity. Sometimes we come back to images to analyse them several years or even decades later, and if that information isn't readily to hand, that image is effectively lost to science.
Mm, exactly, yeah. And how do people actually submit their images?
They send them electronically. There are several organisations in the world that allow you to upload images to websites where they can be looked at by amateur and professional astronomers. Professionals now take a great interest in these high-resolution images, and I'm very happy to have them emailed to myself. We also have within the British Astronomical Association, we have our own members' pages, so members can also put their images up onto their own personal web pages. But I really do prefer if people send them directly to me, because I'm just an ordinary person with a limited amount of spare time, and it's better if I receive them rather than go hunting for them on the internet.
Exactly, yeah. And your email is?
RichardMcKim@btinternet.com.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And how many submissions do you get a week, and how many could you handle?
Well, when I've had some really close perihelic oppositions, and the best one was 2003, when Mars was closest, the closest it had been for the in recorded history, in all of recorded human history, we had over 250 observers, and many of these were observing once every few nights. So, as you can imagine, I was getting quite a lot of email at that time. At the moment, Mars was in opposition this summer. It's not so well placed from the UK, so maybe only one or two images per day at the moment. So it does vary quite a lot.
But there's still a steady trickle, isn't it? That's good.
Oh, absolutely, yes, because although Mars is getting small, there are people with telescopes there who can make the observations, and there are people throughout the world. We've got a worldwide network of observers, from people who make observations in the Southern Hemisphere, whose contributions are always very useful.
And is there something that you'd like to discover? Is there something in your head that you think, oh, I wish that something one day would reveal that about Mars?
Well, it's always nice to make individual personal discoveries. I tend to make discoveries upon other people's images because they show a lot more than I can see visually. I've been a visual observer. I've always been interested in art, sketching, painting, that sort of thing on an amateur basis. So that's something I do for another hobby. And I tend to make drawings of Mars at the telescope. But I certainly make a great deal of use and discover things on the images sent by other people. I think one of the most important things that we do is to maintain a long-term coverage, and some of the discoveries one can make with a long-term research are probably more important than some of the, if you like, temporary features that we might see that last for just a couple of days on the planet.
Yeah, because obviously that's another advantage of the way that, you know, these things are being submitted, is it allows you to study trends as well as individual images.
Well, that's absolutely right. And one thing that we have done, something I've done a lot of work on, is measuring the size of the polar caps of the planet. Now, these show regular seasonal cycles like the Earth. Of course, Mars is in a way a sort of laboratory planet because it hasn't got humans interfering with it. It hasn't got oceans and that sort of thing. And what's been very interesting is to measure the speed at which the polar caps evaporate in the Martian summer. And If you take the best data from 2003, for example, and you compare them with some good historical data, and probably the best historical year we'd have in the past would be 1956, when there was a worldwide campaign to observe it. If you compare the curves which show the latitude or the size of the Martian polar cap as a function of time, you'll find that those two curves are identical. So during the last half century, the polar caps on Mars have shown absolutely no systematic change at all. There are random changes from year to year due to dust storm activity, but there's been no long-term change, and therefore one can infer from that any changes that we might have noticed in our own Earth environment are due to us.
Excellent. And final question now. There's obviously this massive dust storm that covered Mars for most of this year, or a lot of this year. Did any of the contributions reveal anything interesting about that?
They do. What was very unusual about that particular event was that it began in the northern hemisphere of the planet. And although we have had many of these phenomena to study in the past, almost all of them have begun in the south, where the wind speed is higher, the temperature is higher. This one was really quite unusual in beginning in the northern hemisphere of the planet. In fact, it was probably more than one event that caused the planet to have a planet encircling dust storm this year. It also occurred pretty early in the Martian year. There are certain times these storms can begin and grow large. If they start too early in the year, they don't grow fast enough. They don't encircle the planet. If they start too late, for a similar reason. So this began right at the start of the earliest possible moment in the southern hemisphere dust storm season, except that it began in the north. Hmm. And I'm sure these things are planned to annoy amateur astronomers. The same thing happened back in 2001.
Yeah, it's as the weather on Mars is as bad as the weather here in England.
Yes, I'm sure it is. It's probably a little bit more predictable. Although I'm not sure about that. Ours is always pretty poor, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, thank you very much. It's been very interesting. Thanks for talking to us.
It was a great pleasure to speak to you. Thanks very much for inviting me.
That was Dr. Richard McKim of the British Astronomical Association. You can find out more about how you can help further the science being done on Mars with your own observations in the December issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. And there's lots to see in the night sky this month, which you can find out all about in our guide to the night sky in the magazine. But if there's one night you should circle on your calendar for some observing in December, it's the night of the 13th and 14th, which is the peak of the Geminid meteor shower. Now, this is up there with the Perseids as one of the big annual meteor showers. And it's usually one of the stronger showers in terms of activity. Now, the way strength of meteor showers is compared is by using a theoretical figure called the zenithal hourly rate, or ZHR. And that figure for the Geminids is 120. The Perseids in summer is just 100, by the way. Now, the ZHR is an ideal number of meteors you'd see in an hour if your sky was completely clear, it was perfectly dark, the shower was overhead, and you had the omnipresence to see in all directions. And the actual visual weight rate, or AVR, is almost always less. And for the Geminids, it'll probably be something more like 50 meteors an hour. The peak of the Geminids is on the night of the 13th and 14th, when Gemini, the constellation that this shower appears to come from, will be relatively high in the east by 9 or 10 o'clock. So wrap up warm, grab a sun lounger and a blanket, and look about two-thirds of the way up to directly overhead from the horizon, and get counting, see how many meteors you can spot. The moon sets just before 10 p.m, so the rest of the night will be nice and dark for a good spot of meteor watching. That's it from us this month. You can find out more about making your observations of Mars science worthy in the December issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also look forward to the best observing in 2019, get an expert eye on creating 360-degree panoramas of the night sky, and cover some of Spain's darkest sights to go and escape the cold in. And don't forget our regular sections, which will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.